I've called this lecture Dharma and Devi through women's eyes. And I want to talk a little bit about Dharma again, looking at Dharma both from the standpoint of women and from men, also to look at some of the heroines of the Hindu tradition and the goddesses of the Hindu tradition, to begin to get some sense of what it might be like to be a woman in this tradition. We looked last time at the Bhagavad Gita, at the field of Dharma, on which this war, whether you want to call it a real war or the inner struggle of Dharma, is waged. So I want to return to Dharma this hour. It's such an important word in the Hindu tradition, and if one were to pick one word to express what we in the English-speaking world mean by religion, it would probably be this word Dharma. Dharma can be translated as order, as law, as right, as righteousness, as duty, as justice, and it preserves some of the wider semantic field of this term religion, which has become a very thingish word, you might say, in the West. Some of us have a very narrow understanding of what religion means. In fact, one of my own teachers, Wilfred Cantwell Smith, wrote a book called The Meaning and End of Religion, in which he basically argues that we probably should cease to use this word as a noun in English, in part because we think that we have circumscribed a certain set of activities when we use the noun religion, when in fact for religious people in every religious tradition, it's really all of life that is religion. It's not just the things you do on Fridays if you're a Muslim, or Saturdays if you're a Jew, or Sundays if you're a Christian. It's everything, how you order your entire life. The Dharma of your entire life is what religion is. And so Wilfred Cantwell Smith suggests that we use the adjective religious as a way of speaking about everything we do, rather than be misled by this noun religion, as if it could circumscribe just a certain set of activities. And religion, like Dharma, is what centers and upholds and makes meaningful all activities, not just those things that we do in certain places and certain times. What if Arjuna were a woman struggling on the edge of the battlefield with Dharma? This is the question I would address today. From the Gita itself, we don't have too much mention of women. We do have passages in speaking about bhakti and some of those sermons on bhakti that the honoring of the Lord with flowers or with leaves or with water, that these simple offerings to the Lord are gratefully received, that one doesn't have to be rich, one doesn't have to be a king able to sponsor yajnas to make ritual offerings, that in fact equally efficacious are those simple offerings of a few flowers given with a heart full of bhakti to God. And for instance, it is said that you don't have to be a Brahmin or a scholar or a king to do this, but even a servant, even a scavenger, even a woman can make these offerings. So we do have some sense that women are included in the ritual world of the Bhagavad Gita. But there is, though not in the Gita and elsewhere in the teachings about Dharma, there is articulated such a thing as Stri Dharma, or the Dharma of women. And the locus classicus of Dharma texts are called Dharma Shastras, and there are many Dharma Shastras, really, but the one that is most widely known in the English-speaking world, and in a way is probably most widely known in India as well, is called the Manava Dharma Shastra, or the Laws of Manu. And the Laws of Manu have been translated into English in the Sacred Books of the East series by George Bueller, and more recently translated in the Penguin Classics series by Wendy Doniger and Brian Smith. So now they're available, the Laws of Manu, in your local bookstore, and you can read them and contemplate what Dharma means in all of its inflections in Hindu society, or at least what one take on Dharma might mean. And again, we're going back a couple of thousand years here in looking at this portrayal of Dharma through the eyes of Dharma Shastra. A glance at the table of contents gives you a sense that Dharma means a great deal of things. The laws of Manu, for example, begin with the story of creation. That's an interesting way to begin a law book, to tell the story of divine order as it was created. And in fact, you see the story of the cosmic egg splitting apart, being pillared apart, heaven and earth pillared apart by Prajapati, and the various contents of the egg becoming the contents of the world. This is what establishes the order of the world, so to speak. And it also covers, in subsequent chapters, ritual activities, the various stages of life, subjects such as contracts and inheritance, and moral order. So there's a tremendous amount included in a book like The Laws of Manu. As for women, The Laws of Manu contains both praise of women and a clear subordination of women to men in the fulfilling of Dharma. Women's Dharma is more or less attached to the Dharma of men, and I'll talk about that in a moment. On the praise side, we find the Manava Dharma Shastra saying, "Where women are worshipped, there the gods are delighted. But where they are not worshipped, all religious ceremonies become futile. The welfare of a family depends upon the woman," it is said. "Women are a gift from the gods." Manu says a teacher is venerable, a guru is venerable, but a father is 10 times more venerable than the teacher, and a mother 1,000 times more venerable than the father. So we have a certain appreciation of the role of woman in the household. On the negative side, we find passages that depict women as wholly fickle, unreliable, corrupt, prone to addiction, lusting continually after sex and therefore have to be guarded by men. Good looks, it says, do not matter to them, nor do they care about youth. A man, they say, and enjoy sex with him, whether he is good-looking or ugly. So it's this kind of portrayal of women as needing to be kept under wraps, lest they run wild. And the importance of women being kept under the control of men is articulated twice in a familiar verse from the Laws of Manu. Her father guards her in childhood, her husband guards her in youth, and her sons guard her in old age. A woman is not fit for independence. So probably the most overarching thing, not the only thing one could say about the Dharma of women, is that women are essential to the Dharma of men, and that it is perceived by the tradition to be fulfilling for women to have this role of being those who follow along with their husbands to enable the two of them together to fulfill the Dharma of the husband. They're seen as valuable partners to their husbands. And we read, for example, in Manu and in other sources as well, that a Hindu man is born with 3 debts to pay off in his lifetime: a debt to the sages, a debt to the gods, and a debt to the ancestors. And a man, and here we're talking about one of the upper 3 varnas, 3 castes, the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, or Vaishyas, a man pays his debt to the sages, to the wise people of old, by learning the Vedas, by preserving that authoritative revelation that has been so important for the tradition. And only twice-born men can learn the Vedas. It is true that some women, like Gargi, whom you remember from the Upanishads, are very much seekers. They ask those cosmic questions across what is time and space, woven, warp, and woof. And yet, as you recall, she was admonished by Yajnavalkya not to ask too many questions or her head would fall off. But in any case, the first debt is the debt to the sages to be repaid by learning the sacred lore. The second debt is the debt to the gods, and that is repaid by performing the sacrifice, or the yajna. This is the means through which the gods are fed, so to speak, through which one's gratitude is also expressed to the divine realm. Now, only householders perform the sacrifice. Thus, women are, in a sense, absolutely necessary in order for a man to pay this ritual debt. A wife-husband team, so to speak, are the performers of the domestic sacrifice. The man is the one who performs the sacrificial oblation. The indebtedness of a man to the gods, however, cannot be performed by a man who is single. You have to be married in order to do it. And if you were to see one of those elaborate cosmic rites of the yajna, even as they're performed today in as sort of showpieces almost in contemporary India, the yajamana is continually with his wife, who is usually a bit obscure behind him, but the two of them are there together. Now, the third debt, the debt to the ancestors, is repaid by having offspring. And not only offspring, but a son. Sons are absolutely necessary in order to perform one's own funeral rites. The lighting of the cremation pyre at the time of death is performed by the son, and that the rites of death that enable one to cross over to the world of the ancestors, these rites called Shraddha, are performed by the sons, and the perpetual remembrance of the dead through monthly and yearly rituals called Tarpana also are performed by the sons. And all of this is premised on having a son to perform it, so that the importance of having sons is absolutely critical in enabling one to repay that debt to the ancestors by perpetrating the race, so to speak. Now, mind you, we haven't yet heard anything of what women are supposed to do, but we do know that at least two of these debts can't be repaid unless there's a woman involved. You can repay the debt to the sages by learning the Vedas, and there women are not, at least as the system develops, they're not supposed to learn the Vedas, but you cannot repay the debts to the gods or the ancestors without having a wife. Now, the same thing is true in the laws of Manu in describing what are called the four ashramas, or stages of life. And this term ashrama here, it sounds a lot like the word ashram. In fact, it's the same word. When we talked about the forest retreats of ancient India, these ashrams where the sages, the gurus, taught their students, these kind of open universities of the forest, those are ashrams. This word is more or less the same, but it's used in this context to refer to what became known as the stages of life through which a person, again a man, would pass on a life course. And there are four of them: the stage of the celibate student, the brahmachari, the stage of the householder, or the grihastha, the stage of the retiree, or the vanaprastha, the forest dweller, and fourth, the stage of the sannyasi, or the renouncer, who leaves all of that behind. And I want to talk briefly about each of those, asking again this question of what they tell us, not only about the Dharma of men, but what they tell us about the Dharma of women. Now, the brahmachari, the student stage of life, involves both celibacy and study with a teacher. And again, I have to remind you that what we're talking about here is kind of an ideal type. I'm not suggesting that this is observed traditionally in throughout Indian history, nor that it is observed in terms of four stages today, but almost everyone knows what these four stages are, and they are indeed articulated and upheld in the Dharma Shastras, the books that talk about Dharma. So first, the brahmachari, and for boys of the upper three varanas, that stage begins with an initiation rite in which the boy is, in a sense, reborn. That initiation rite is called the Upanayana. It means being led to the guru. The young boy, maybe a boy of 12 or something like that, is brought to the guru for instruction and lives with the guru, as we saw in the Upanishads, learning from him, keeping his fires, being of service to him. But the rite of commencing instruction of sacred lore is called an Upanayana. And in that ritual, the young boy receives a sacred thread that is worn over the shoulder and under the arm. and receives the sacred mantra called the Gayatri Mantra, which he is to repeat every morning of his life. And he commences the study of the sacred tradition. He whose first birth is from the womb of his mother is now reborn, this time at the hands of the guru. And he becomes literally a twice-born person, a dvija, as they call it. And these upper three varnas are referred to as the twice-born castes, because the young men of these castes each experience a second birth. Now, this notion of initiation in which the natural birth from the mother is superseded by a spiritual birth from the father is not unique to this Hindu tradition. It is part of the common structure of what one might describe as patriarchal religion the world over. Even in Christian baptism, for example, one birth is not enough, so to speak. The natural birth from the mother is appropriated, so to speak, by the second birth at the hands of the fathers, at the hands of the priests, the male-centered tradition, at least through most of Christian history, until we started having women priests, which, as you can see, somewhat alters some of this symbolism. But there is a sense that the natural birth needs to be superseded by a birth at the hands of the father. And for anyone who, as I do, looks critically at the structure of patriarchal traditions, this is an important point to note, just as a matter of analysis. Now, the second ashrama in this system is the grihastha, the householder. And arguably, this is the most important stage of life, because it's only the householder that can repay those debts to the gods and the ancestors. And when he returns from the life of a student, the brahmachari leaves off that period of life, and clearly marriage is next on the horizon. And interestingly, in modern India, where there is sometimes less attention to the religious quality of learning or to the learning of the sacred lore in the traditional way, the Upanayana might often be performed as kind of a preliminary to the marriage rite, even a few days beforehand. But traditionally, one returned from an extensive period of study, left off that period, and then was married. In any case, Manu, in the laws of Manu, tells us that a young man should get married to a woman, and the ideal woman is described. A woman should be free from bodily defects. She should have an agreeable name. She should have the graceful gait of a goose or an elephant, both of whom are seen to walk with a kind of grace that should typify a woman. She should have a moderate quantity of bodily hair, small teeth, and soft limbs. And as Manu puts it, there is unwavering good fortune in a family where the husband is always satisfied by the wife, and the wife by the husband. But if the woman is radiant, the whole family is radiant. If she is not radiant, the whole family is not radiant. So there's an importance that is ascribed to the woman in this householder stage of life, to be sure. The householder is the pivot of society. The rights of the householder support both the living and the dead. If you really look at it, all of the other three ashramas are not really involved in the economic sustenance of society. The brahmachari depends on others for well-being and for food. The vanaprastha, the retired forest dweller, and the sannyasi also are not involved in the sort of getting and keeping, as they call it, in society. So the householder becomes the sort of pivot of the entire culture. And for many, they would say that the householder is certainly the most important stage of life. And the sense of family that is cultivated in this tradition is a much wider sense of family. Again, not simply the nuclear family, not simply the family extending horizontally out to uncles and cousins and what we would call distant relatives, but it's also a sense of family responsibility that extends through time back into the generations of those who have gone before, that one has a responsibility toward grandfathers and grandmothers and the generations before them who have already died, and a ritual responsibility to remember them and to make offerings, etc., as well as a responsibility for the generations ahead. So the sense of household in which the householder moves is a very large sense of household. Now let me move ahead to the Vanaprastha. Here it's said in Manu that when a householder sees his skin begin to wrinkle, his hair turn gray, his grandson born, he should resort to the forest. As for his wife, he may either take her along or not, but usually she would go with him if we were speaking of the ideal world here. He may also take with him the implements for the daily domestic fire offerings. In the forest, he should wear simple clothes and eat fruits and vegetables that have fallen from the trees. It's seen as a stage of retirement in which the management of life has been turned over to the next generation in the household. While it is somehow less official, perhaps less clearly delineated than the first two stages, the retirement stage of life is a move on from the full responsibilities of the householder and turning it over to the sons of the household, essentially. The fourth and final stage is called sannyasa, which means renunciation, literally casting off. That's what sannyasa means, as if you're casting off the lines of the boat from this shore and making off to the far shore. And the far shore, of course, in both the Hindu and the Buddhist traditions and the Jain tradition, all of these traditions, the far shore becomes a kind of symbol of the goal of the spiritual quest, the freedom of the spiritual quest. The rites of sannyasa are not described by Manu, but there are particular rites. For many, it is simply cutting off ties with family once for all, leaving home, and those ties are indeed cast off, broken. For others, the commencement of sannyasa is marked with a rite of cremation, and one actually lays down upon one's own funeral pyre and leaves behind, literally, all that is associated with kama and artha and dharma, all that is associated with the getting and keeping the concerns of this world. And you rise from the cremation pyre on which that old self has been burned, so to speak, a new person. If a man were to become a sannyasi at the final stage of life, as is held up here as the ideal, he would indeed leave behind his wife and his family. And the renunciation is not only the renunciation of rituals. The sannyasi does not perform any domestic daily fire offerings, any of the Agnihotra that he would have performed every day of his life from the time he learned it. The sannyasi does not, on the whole, perform worship in any of the temples of contemporary India. It is not only the renunciation of ritual, it is not only the renunciation of wealth, because the sannyasi leaves all of that behind as well, but it's also the renunciation of those relationships which every person in Hindu society is embedded in, that whole nexus of relationships. And that means the renunciation of wife and children, if those are still alive. And even if that sannyasi were to return to his own home to seek alms, to seek a daily meal, as the sannyasis would, he would not acknowledge in any way the bond that has now been cut. So it is a radical leaving go of. And the sannyasi, according to the laws of Manu, should wander with no fixed dwelling. He should go his way alone, wearing coarse garments, dwelling for the night by the root of a tree, begging for food to sustain life. Let him not be sorry when he obtains nothing, nor rejoice when he obtains something. And the aim of the sannyasi is something quite different from what we think of as the sorrowing and the rejoicing and the cause of those things in daily life. The aim of the sannyasi is freedom, moksha, liberation, liberation from all of this. Liberation even from dharma, which is the interesting thing, to have the life of a sannyasi described in the law books of Dharma, because it is leaving Dharma behind as well. Now, we've seen, in a way, by implication, what these stages of the man's life might entail for the roles of women. And if we were to revisit these stages, looking at how a woman is supposed to steer her course through life, according to the Dharma Shastra pattern, what would you find, really? And I think if one were to try to articulate the stages of a woman's life according to Dharma, in most of the Hindu tradition, it would be defined primarily, precisely, by the relationships that Manu defines. And that is the relationship as a daughter, as a wife, as a mother, maybe at the end as a widow. And I want to speak a little bit about each of those now. Manu makes it quite clear, a young girl, a young woman, even an old woman, should not do anything independently, even in her own house. In childhood, again, a woman should be under her father's control. In youth, under her husband's. When her husband is dead, under her son's. She should not have independence. So the stages of a woman in this context are wholly relational. And as I explore these stages, we don't really have so much to go on in the laws of Manu. We have a lot of anthropology that's done in contemporary Indian villages, for example, that talk about what a woman's life is like. We have a lot of implication. We have, in fact, some articulations in the Dharma Shastras of Stri Dharma, of how a woman should behave, what are the duties she should undertake in relation to her husband especially. But let's just go through those stages briefly. First, of a daughter. The daughter has a very poignant role in the Hindu family. As it is said very commonly, daughters are raised for someone else's family. And that's said without with a real sense of poignance about it. In one sense, daughters are guests in the very families in which they grow up. And the primary locus of a daughter's life eventually will be in her relatedness with her husband's family. In fact, she eventually will take membership officially in her husband's family. Manisha Roy, in writing about the mother-daughter relations in Bengal, a wonderful book called Bengali Women, describes the special intensity of the mother-daughter relation, a relation that is close in part because of the unconscious identification of the mother with her daughters, because she knows already from her own experience some of the pain that her daughter will experience in leaving behind her natal home and in marrying into a family of virtual strangers. Daughters will, of course, come home to visit, and one of the wonderful parts of the ritual calendar of the Hindu religious year, which is filled with festivals, is that there are many of those festivals for which, especially, the daughters go back to their natal families and go back to their own villages. But as one old mother-in-law put it to her somewhat unhappy daughter-in-law, daughters only come to visit, and you and I must stay together. Now, what about a wife? It is often said that the sacrament of marriage is to a woman what the Upanayana, the investiture with the sacred thread, is to a man. These rites for women have the same binding structure as those which earlier in her husband's life he would have undertaken when he began to study with a guru. And I think that's an important place to begin, that marriage is the ritual equivalent for women of the Upanayana in this traditional view of things. The rite by which boys gain access to the tradition as learners and as participants, in which they in a sense become adults in the tradition, is the Upanayana. And it's marriage that gives the woman her full ritual status in the tradition. While the man's ritual and religious life entails obligations to the gods and the sages and the ancestors, the woman's ritual and religious life entails obligations primarily to her husband. She is called Pativrata, Literally, she whose religious obligation or vow, vrata, is to her husband, and her husband is called pati. In the laws of Manu, we have the following prescription. A virtuous wife should constantly serve her husband like a god, even if he behaves badly, freely indulges his lust, and is devoid of any good qualities. Apart from their husbands, women cannot sacrifice or undertake a vow or a fast. It is because a wife obeys her husband that she is exalted in heaven. That's pretty tough to take for people who are thinking about these things in terms of contemporary equality for women. But there really is a sense here, and again, I think one can't interpret or construe this material as if it is the only inroad into insight in women's lives in India. But this is part of a fairly important set of ritual and dharmic prescriptions. The pativrata, and I want to explore that because it is an important term in the tradition, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the stories associated with it in a few minutes. The marriage rite is important both for women and men, and it is unquestionably the single most auspicious and celebrated ritual occasion in Hindu India. And I think there's probably no better clue to social structure generally than the analysis of marriage rites. It's not surprising if we look, for example, at marriage rites of the contemporary Christian West and of Hindu India side by side, we find a tremendous difference in the nature and complexity of these rites. A contemporary Christian rite of marriage, at least if it's in the Protestant church and at least if it doesn't involve Holy Communion as part of it, takes about 15 minutes at the most. You know, you're in, you're out of there. It's relatively simple in its ritual structure. It focuses largely on the man, on the woman, the exchange of vows, the immediate families of the two, etc. And its structural simplicity and leanness conveys the message that the task to be performed is fairly straightforward, that to join this man and this woman in holy matrimony, as the Christian marriage rite says. Now, simplicity is nowhere to be found in the Hindu marriage rite. It is a very complicated rite. It takes many days. The rites are polycentric, just as the joint family and the families that are joined in these rites are polycentric. The rituals involve a host of sub-themes and participants and subplots. The primary rites themselves take several hours. And it's the single most important, most auspicious, most joyful event in the life of a Hindu family. The whole thing is called Mangala. And that term Mangala simply means the auspicious. And it is auspicious. Red is worn, and red is the auspicious color for brides, for auspiciousness in the tradition. There are processions, there are welcomings, there are feastings and gift givings, and embedded within all of that a set of binding rites for the man and the woman that consist of joining their hands, tying their garments together, the bride standing on a stone to signify her steadfastness, the groom touching his wife's heart, circling the sacred fire together, most important of all, the seven steps, each with its binding significance. And throughout all of these rites, the new bride actually becomes a member of her husband's family. And there's a great deal of lore about the life of a new daughter-in-law in the Hindu family. She is the youngest new member of the family, so to speak. And for many brides in traditional India, where marriages may have been arranged or partially arranged, where at least to a great extent the husband and wife do not know each other as well as brides and grooms may know each other in the modern West, there is a sense in which the most important person in her life as a new bride may not even be her husband at all, but may be her mother-in-law. Because the mother-in-law, if you look at the power structure of this joint family, has a certain kind of very important power. And it is not elaborately written into the Dharma Shastra, but it's certainly part of the unwritten dharma of the household. And the head of the household as a woman, the mother-in-law, the wife of the oldest living male member of the household is usually the keeper of the keys, and she'll have a big bunch of keys on the belt of her sari. There's a tremendous amount of power associated with this. And the vulnerability of the young bride is a matter of lore, is also the situation in some cases of tragic exploitation. In the case of the dowry deaths in India today, for example, precisely the vulnerability of the new bride makes possible the extortionary demands for new dowry, for continued dowry payments from her natal family. And the involvement of mother-in-laws in this kind of oppression is well known. I mention that not because this is a normal part of the tradition. Every tradition has its ugly distortions of some of its deepest values. And certainly the deaths of young brides in Hindu families in urbanizing India today is a very deep distortion of these traditions. If you want to get a sense of some of the lives of women in India today, there are a number of books. One that's most recently come out in the U.S. is by Elizabeth Buemiller, called May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons. And it's about an insight into some of the worlds of Hindu women. Now that takes us to the second of these stages I'd like to say something about. That is, as a mother, May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons is a blessing. And it also is one of the prescriptions for a Hindu woman to be a mother. And indeed, the young bride status rises immeasurably in the family when her first children are born, especially if it's a son, especially if it's a boy. And it's often said that the primary affective link in a Hindu complex family is the link between the mother and the son, and you can certainly see why this would be the case. The son, when born, gives the mother a whole new sense of prestige and self-assurance. And having a son child is virtually prescribed in order to fulfill that debt to the ancestors, so to speak. So it's not surprising that if one were to look at the primary psychological dynamic of some Hindu families, it's one in which the young bride comes almost as an intruder into a very close relationship between the mother and the son. And that also makes for some very interesting stories and novels and situations. Now, let me move to the final stage and just say a word about widowhood. This is not a desired final stage of life. In Banaras, the wife of my elderly teacher, my beloved pundit, used to say, "May I die wearing red." And what she meant by that was, "May I die a married woman. May I die before my husband." And that's an important perception, that the domestic rites that women commonly perform, they're called vratas, or vows, or rituals that are performed of storytelling and worship and fasting. These vratas, and there are hundreds of them really, are performed by women not for their own personal benefit, but are performed largely to ensure the well-being of their families, of their children, and especially of their husbands. Therefore, the pativrata, the one whose vrata is to her husband, in a sense has failed, you might say, or it might be construed that way, that the pativrata has failed if her husband dies before she does. Widowhood is not valued, and remarriage of a widow is, at least in traditional India, out of the question. There's no mention in the laws of Manu of the rite of sati, in which a woman is burned on the funeral pyre with her husband. But that's not to say that this rite is not known in other Dharma Shastras. And in some ways, that would be seen as perfectly consonant with the pativrata, with a woman's religious orientation entirely toward the welfare of her husband, and almost as the ultimate expression of it. And I don't want to go into the elaborate debate traditionally and contemporarily about these rites of sati, but clearly the position of widows is very vulnerable. They are to be cared for by their sons, but on the whole, the widow loses her status in the household. She is no longer Sumangala, the auspicious one, and is truly dependent upon her sons. There are, however, very powerful widows in India, if you think of Indira Gandhi, for example, as a widow who rose to supreme power. Now, let me say just a word about the Pativrata, if we're to talk about them in story form, because the shape of our human experience is not primarily cast by codes of conduct like this, but by stories about real people. And there are lots of stories of Pativratas in Hindu literature, in the epics, and in the Puranas. Let me just mention two of them. The first is a story of a woman named Savitri, who was very independent, who drove through the land in a chariot to inspect all of the potential suitors that she might have and choose the most virtuous man she could find. And she chose a young man named Satyavan, who was living with his blind father, and he became the choice of her heart. And so they approached him for marriage, and of course she's the one doing the choosing, mind you, in this story. And the astrologer tells him that Satyavan unfortunately has one flaw, which is that he's going to die in a year. And Savitri says, "My heart is chosen, I'm not choosing again." And she marries him. And at the end of about a year, they're out in the forest. He's cutting down trees with an axe, and he feels a little sick. He lies down and falls asleep, and pretty soon the god of death, Yama, comes to him and starts to take him away. And Savitri follows. She goes along where her husband is going, and Yama turns to her and says, "You can't follow him. I'm death. I'm taking him to the land of death." She says, "I have to follow him." Yama is impressed with her fortitude, and he gives her a boon. And what does she choose as a first boon? It is to give sight to her father-in-law, because she anticipates that if his son Satyavan is gone, he's going to need to be able to see to get along without him. So that's her first boon. She follows along behind Yama, and he gives her a second boon. The second boon is to restore her father-in-law's lost kingdom, which he had lost. The third boon, finally, is, "May I have 100 sons through Satyavan, for I am as dead without my husband. Deprived of my husband, I wish no bliss, no fortune, no heaven. Without my lord, I will not live." And Yama gives her this boon and finally releases her husband. Now, Savitri's story is known to virtually every woman in India. They don't have to read the laws of Manu. They know Savitri's story. It is the story of a woman who followed her husband and won him back from the jaws of death. It's a story of a very powerful Pativrata. So Pativrata cannot be identified with powerlessness. Now, let me give you another example. This is from South India. It's the story of a woman named Kaniki in a South Indian epic called the Shilapadikaram. And her husband isn't a very faithful husband. He has been playing around with other women. And finally, they decide to make a new start, the two of them together. Her husband's name is Kovalan. And they go to the city of Madurai, still a thriving city in Tamil Nadu in South India. They're virtually penniless, so they find shelter at the edge of town in the house of a cattle keeper. And Kovalan, the husband, takes the only thing that they have left of value, which is his wife's golden ankle bracelet, and he takes it into the city to see if he can sell it for some money. And he does. He goes to a goldsmith, and the goldsmith sees it and agrees to buy it. And the goldsmith also turns out to be a crook, because it turns out that he actually stole the queen's anklet that looked very much like this one. So he thinks in his mind he's going to pin this crime on poor old Kovalan, which he does. He goes to the king. He says, "I hear your wife's anklet has been stolen, and you know, I think I've found the criminal." And Kovalan is dragged before the king, and they see the anklet looks just like the one the queen lost, and Kovalan is executed on the spot. And gradually, Kaniki is sitting back on the edge of town, a stranger in this town, in the cattle keeper's village, hears rumors. Her husband hasn't returned. She doesn't know what has happened. She gradually hears that he has been taken for a thief and executed. And she does not wait a moment. She goes out into the streets of the city. She goes to the very court of the king. She says that the anklet was hers. She makes the king break the anklet open and finds that it has little gems inside of it rather than the pearls that were inside of his wife's anklet. And she goes with this injustice being done against her husband into the streets of Madurai and asks, is there no woman here? Is there no real woman? Or only the sort of woman who would allow such injustice to be done to her husband? Is there no honest man here? Or only the sort of man who nourishes and protects only the sons of his own blood? Can there be God in a land where the sword of the king is used for the murder of innocent strangers? And this woman, and this again is an epic that is told throughout South India, she marches around the city of Madurai three times. She tears off her left breast. She hurls it into the city, and it bursts into fire and explodes and burns down the unjust kingdom of the king. Now, I tell this story again because it reshapes some of the image of Pativrata we have. That Pativrata is not only the story about women who are powerless, but is also a story about women who are powerful. And we return to that primary definition of Dharma. Dharma rakshati rakshita. Dharma protected. Protect.